We'll discuss how to achieve a better work-life balance during this edition of On Your Money, plus some end-of-the-year money moves that you could consider. And best of all, we have reason to talk about butter burgers and frozen custard. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is also looking forward to answering your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and we have the pleasure of Kevin's presence in our Madison studios this morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Hello. Joy.
So it is good to see you. It's always nice to talk with you, but I get to see you today.
Lucky you.
And how are you going to help us better our work-life balance, Kevin?
Quit. Yeah, go ahead and walk. Let's go.
That'll give me more home balance.
Yeah, it will, but your finances might suffer a little bit. We put together several studies that may make you feel better about your employment situation and your work-life balance. Or they may not, but we went through by country, by profession, by company, and by location.
And let's start with location.
Okay, this is the 2013 Better Life Index conducted by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OED countries. 36 countries, the United States ranked 28th in work-life balance among all of these countries. Denmark was first, and to give you an idea of why Denmark was first, only 2% of workers in Denmark work more than 50 hours per week. Full-time workers, only 2% in Denmark work more than 50 hours per week versus 10% for the United States. And those are people who actually report it. The other ones just said, I don't want to know how many hours over 50 I actually work, so I'm not going to report it. In the United States, the average vacation, paid vacation for full-time workers is 10 days per week. It's 10 days per year, rather, 25 days per year for Denmark, 30 days per year for Germany, and Brazil gets about the same amount, plus 11 paid holidays as well. And this will give you a good idea of where we stand. 134 countries in the world have laws which limit the amount of hours workers can put in during a given week. The United States is not one of those that has it. And when we talk about vacation, speaking of Labor Day coming up, only about 50% of Americans actually take all of the paid vacation that they are allotted. And a lot of people wonder why that is. Some people say, well, geez, I get kind of a lot of slack at work if I take my time off. But most of the people who I feel don't do it because they need the money or they can't afford to actually take a trip. More likely, though, they work on the kind of projects and jobs where if they leave work, that just means there's more work when they eventually get back. And the longer they leave, the more work there is when they get back. And they say, hey, it's just hard enough the way it is, and I don't want to make this even more difficult than it already is.
Sometimes it's hard to prepare for a vacation by doing all the work ahead of time so you can go on
vacation.
That's
right. That's the hardest I ever work is when I'm actually going on vacation a few days later.
Well, what about regions within the U.S.? Is there any difference there?
Yeah, an interesting study from NerdWallet, the website where they took a look at hours worked in a community, the average commute, the wages, and the cost of living according to rent. Rent was the gauge that they used. And what they found was that the best communities for work-life balance were Bloomington, Indiana, Provo, Utah, Gainesville, Florida, and coming in at number 4, Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
That's interesting,
yeah,
isn't it?
A little surprising. But they found that the worst ones were generally suburbs around the D.C. area. And while they certainly may be true, one thing I found with a lot of the cities that they named as the top cities for work-life balance, is those were college towns and generally had a higher paid workforce, lower cost of living, and most importantly, low rent because they were renting to a lot of students as well, too.
Yeah. So what professions had the highest level of work-life balance?
Did not see radio hosts mentioned here, not because you don't, the online career site Glassdoor judged careers by the flexibility reported by the people working in that occupation and how much they liked the people with whom they were working. And they found an interesting disparity. There were a lot of jobs, tech jobs like search engine optimization consultant or data engineer or investment analyst, but then lifeguard, substitute teacher, all those people said, no, I feel like I have a good work-life balance. Even though I don't get paid particularly highly, I like the people I work with. I feel like I have some flexibility. I can work when I want, and when I don't want to, I don't have to work. And so that flexibility is the thing that reigns supreme in all of these different occupations.
What about financial planners?
Financial planners actually do report a fairly high level of work-life balance because they like what they do, and they get to work generally with the people with whom they want to work in terms mm-hmm. of clients and in terms of fellow employees. They work a lot of hours and a lot of strange hours. You can work nights and weekends a lot, too. But generally, along with actuaries, it's one of those surprising occupations that people don't even know exist until they're adults, but actually do report a fairly high level of satisfaction.
What about the employers?
According to the website Glassdoor, which is very interesting, by the way, because they offer, it's kind of like a Yelp for employers, and where people can report in on what it's like to work for a particular company. And if you don't like your particular employer, you may want to check this, because a lot of other people don't like their employers either. And so you may think that it's just the place you work that's crazy or stressful, but it's going on all over the place. A lot of similar fields were reported to have companies that offered a good work-life balance, like information technology, finance, software, and oil. A lot of the companies like Chevron, Shell, Royal Dutch reported a brains versus brawn attitude, higher margins of sales, and that allowed more flexibility, and people could work remotely and at home, which they really liked. The only regional company we had in our area was Morningstar, the mutual fund company we refer to quite a bit, based in Chicago, mm-hmm. Illinois.
Well, you know, a lot of us want to get more balance in our lives, work-life balance, but it's a pretty big step to, as we said in the beginning, quit the job or change employers or change careers. How can we, or even move, how can we try to get more balance in our lives?
On a personal basis, you might want to start by using just one calendar for your life, you know, for both work and home, so you kind of know where everybody is supposed to be at a particular time all on one page. Try to shorten your commute down as much as you possibly can. That's really the killer for a lot of people, because it's one thing to be at work and getting paid to do work. It's another thing to just be sitting stuck in traffic if you can help it. Don't check your email on vacation, and do keep that free time as sacred as you possibly can, where you're not staring at your phone waiting for a text from your boss or whatever. And then go to your workplace. And right now, this is as good a time as any in the last several years to ask for what you need. It might be an afternoon off during the week, or a day off, an extra day off during the month, or the ability to work from home. And especially if the subject of pay comes up, you might be valuing your time more than money. And you might say, look, I don't need a raise, but I would like is a little bit more time off or a little bit more flexibility. And finally, it brings a point home for the personal finance side of this. If you can reduce your spending down to a lower level, it increases your flexibility in terms of where you have to work and when you have to work. And it also increases your leverage with a particular employer, because if you need the money to pay the bills, they kind of have you. And if you are able to live below a certain salary level, you have more options.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And that being said, if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, call us now. We have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us on your money at WPR.org. It is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And a listener asks, my son just graduated from the UW and got a great job. He's on my cell phone bill through the end of 2014, and we're trying to decide what his best option is after that. His company pays for his airfare and hotels, but not his cell phone. Will he be able to, and should he, count on that as a business expense? Would it be better for him to take that expense on and start itemizing? Thank you. So, Kevin, what do you think? Is it even possible to deduct one's cell phone expenses?
You did not read any false praise?
He did not have any false praise.
And yet we're still taking the call.
Yeah. Interesting. Calls are lining up.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. It actually is possible to deduct cell phone expenses. You do have to itemize. You do have to pay for the bill yourself. And then it becomes an issue because a lot of people who would like to itemize do not have enough qualifying expenses to make it worthwhile. That's typically medical expenses, mortgage interest, and property taxes are typically the largest itemizable expenses. And unless they exceed the standard amount, which for 2014 is $6,200 for a single person and twice that for a married couple filing jointly, not only can't they deduct it, but it doesn't really make any sense to try to do it.
So it is unlikely that her son could take that tax break.
Yeah, it's unlikely, and especially if in other cases where it's being reimbursed by the employer, provided, no, you can't do that. And that's not the real issue here. What is obviously going on is a loving and proud mother mm-hmm. trying to wean her son off of her financial support as quickly as she possibly can.
So how should she go about doing that?
I would help him find the lowest cost option that he possibly can for his cell phone service. Look around, and there are different options with a provider to say, here are my calls. What can I do to cut this down? And then phase out her support in percentages. Say to him, I'm going to pay this bill for you, but it's going to be 10% less of the bill every single month until it goes to zero. Or set a deadline and say, look, I'm comfortable, you know, helping you get off the dole and on your feet. But at the end of 2014 or 2015 or whatever, you're going to have to support yourself. And what you'll find is that he will start paying a lot closer attention to his expenses if he knows he's going to get it. In the meantime, I would suggest to her that if she is going to pay his cell phone bill, she makes it mandatory that he must take his mother's calls when she calls him.
Yes, and he must call back at least once or twice a week.
Correct.
For sure. We are talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network.
Give me some money.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and our first caller for him is Bob in Madison. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead with your question.
Well, I have a tax question. If you are an heir now and you inherit some securities that over the years have appreciated in value, it's my understanding that you pay no taxes on a paper capital gain. That you inherit them at the price of that day. Now, how does that compare with treasury bonds, EEE bonds, which are probably coming in due today or this year, when you have accrued interest?
Bob,
you reject, I believe. Am I right on that?
Excuse me, Bob. Are you inheriting the bonds, or are you planning on leaving them to someone?
Well, let's say I inherit them.
Okay. If you inherit them, you are generally liable for the taxes on the interest. Typically with savings bonds, people have a choice between either paying taxes on the interest on a year-by-year basis or paying when the bonds are cashed in or mature. And you don't get to change it every single year. And typically what happens is there's a built-up increase in value, if you will, according to the interest being piled onto the bond. And if a person inherits those, then the estate is technically liable for the taxes on the interest, but if you take them and let them running, then you will be liable for taxes on any interest earned after you inherit them.
All right. Thanks very much, Bob, for the call. Let's go next to Karen in Franklin. Hello, Karen.
Good morning. I've got a question about education expenses and on your income taxes. My daughter is going to be, we're actually taking her to Madison tomorrow, and she's beginning there. Now, her money is going to be running out very quickly, the money that she will be using of her own for education, and therefore Mom and Dad will be chipping in quite a bit. What I'm wondering about is whether or not it is best for us to pay the expenses directly from our accounts. She is a dependent, we'd be able to take the education deductions that are available on income tax. Should we be paying the money directly out of our accounts, or would it be all right if we put that money into her accounts and she pays the bills as they come up?
I think you'll get more benefit by paying it directly, in part because when it's an asset in her name with her Social Security number, is she qualifying for any financial aid at all?
Not really. She has a few scholarships, but it won't go very far.
Okay. Well, I would recommend that you and she apply for financial aid every single year by filling out the FAFSA, and I would recommend that you take out any subsidized loans that you qualify for, or even the unsubsidized loans. Just don't take out any private loans if you don't have to. But as part of that, I would like to have the money come out of your account. Don't transfer it into her name. You won't get any big benefit for it. And if she ever does go someplace where they do incorporate assets for the purpose of calculating financial aid, assets in the kid's name and kid's Social Security number will count much more than assets held by the parent. So there's really no benefit gained by sliding it down into her name.
Okay.
Well, congratulations, too, on your daughter coming to UW-Madison. Have you been here before for moving day?
No, I have not. Hopefully it will go smoothly.
Oh, it's very easy.
Yeah,
you'll find a lot
of
people just standing around asking if you need things carried up to the sixth floor or whatever. They're very nice.
I hope it'll all go well. It's going to be busy, though. Let's put it that way.
That's what we've been told. But,
yeah.
She doesn't have an elevator in her building, so hopefully we'll get everything to the third floor without any trouble.
Uh-oh.
Can we help? No, we're busy that
day.
Busy. We are
busy. I'm sorry,
love
Karen.
You'll be there. We'll find someone to help.
Okay.
Good luck. Thanks very much for the call. If you have a question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Vivian in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. False praise. My friends always say, well, how do you know that? And I say, I listen to Kevin McKinley every week.
There we go.
Thank you, Vivian. You have the rest of the hour to discuss anything you'd like to talk about.
Okay. I'm refinancing my home. I qualify with flying colors for a special local credit union promotion of 2.39% with $239 in closing costs. I do have their whatever you call it, best, I don't know, their, I just don't remember what it's called, good faith estimate, that's what it's called.
Okay.
And the catch is, it's a six-year balloon, not an arm, but a balloon. And if I should not have it paid for in 6 years, at that time, I will be 75 years old. And I'm wondering, I know they can't discriminate according to age, but how do people fare with refinances as they age?
Well, let me ask you this, Vivian. What is the purpose behind the refinancing? Do you just want to lower your interest cost? Do you need the money? Are you using it for something specific?
Lower the interest cost particularly and keep my payment where it is right now.
Okay, are you refinancing 80% of the loan to value of the home, or is it just a small portion of it?
It's probably about 45%.
Okay, well, the good news is over 6 years, especially with that extremely low and extremely attractive interest rate and the closing costs, which can't be dismissed. Those are very low. Typical closing costs run about a couple thousand dollars in most cases. So $239 for closing costs is a very good deal. When you are paying that off, you're just going to be paying, almost every payment will be just the principal. The interest will be a very small portion of it. Therefore, you'll whittle down the principal very fast. So even if it does switch to a balloon payment at some point, your chances at that point is what they will do. They'll either say, hey, we need the money from you at this point, or because you have so much equity built up into the home, which you will at that point, we will allow you to change this to a home equity loan or a home equity line of credit or something else that will not force you to just come up with that big balloon payment. Have they given you a dollar amount where they said, Vivian, 6 years from now, what you will have to come up with?
Actually, they did, and they offered to amortize it.
Okay.
And for the time being, I've chosen, I believe, a 15-year amortization, which means it won't be paid off in 6 years. I don't recall the payoff. She did give me a number at the end of 6 years based on that 15-year structure.
Okay, so it's just a question of what the interest rate will be at that time, correct?
Yep.
Okay,
pretty much. And the fact that it's not an arm, it's just, we're not going to, you'll have to figure this out yourself kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's a good. I think it's a bet worth taking, and I think that based on the numbers you've given me, the dollar amount owed at the end of the 6 years is still going to be relatively small and relatively easy. Are you getting Social Security or a pension check right now, Vivian?
Yes, both.
Okay, I'm guessing that it will be so small that the payment will be able to be covered simply by a portion of one of those checks.
Okay, that's what I'm counting on. I just thought, boy, 75, it's like how many more years have you got to pay off a debt, you know?
Well, that's the good. You want to die with a lot of debt. You win if you do.
You're going to live forever, Vivian. All right. Thank you very much for the call, and good luck to you. If you have a question about a money matter, a personal finance issue that's on your mind today, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for smart assets. And for better or worse, there are about 4 months left in 2014.
That can't be right.
I know, I can't believe it. So it could be, it is a good time to look at the money moves that we might want to consider before the end of the year. So why do this now, Kevin?
No, because the tax year, Joy, is the calendar year, of course, for just about everything involved with tax planning and tax saving, except for IRA and Roth IRA contributions, which you can usually make the following April 15th for a particular tax year. The problem, of course, is if you wait too long, like until December, to consider a lot of these things, holidays come up with Thanksgiving, the end of the year holidays, and then you got weekends in there, and you try to find different people. Like if you need information, oh, I need a statement from 2002 or whatever, they're going on their own holidays as well, and it becomes very difficult to get all the information you need and make the transactions that you might need to do, and then it's too late. You might have cost yourself thousands of dollars by waiting this long.
Yeah, so I want to do this. Where do I start?
Let's start by selling your winners and your losers. This would be investments that you hold outside of retirement plans like stocks or mutual funds, and if you have winners, and especially if you have long-term capital gains in there, you might want to rebalance and then try to realize some of those capital gains, because if you can realize them and remain in the 15% federal income tax bracket, you may have a 0% long-term capital gain tax rate on those particular gains. And then in terms of your losers, if you have things that are down in value, you might want to sell those to take the loss. Not only work it against any gains you have, but you can reduce your taxable income by up to $3,000 per year just by selling any losers you have. I mean, let's say you put $10,000 into a stock, it's worth $7,000. Okay, it's worth what it's worth. If you sell it now and realize that loss, that $3,000 will be taken off of your taxable income, and it saves most people anywhere from about $750 up to $1,000 in their taxes by taking that loss.
All right, so after I sell all the losers off, what else do I need to do?
Look at converting IRAs to Roth IRAs, especially if you're in a low income bracket right now and maybe in a higher bracket in the future. When you convert an IRA to a Roth IRA, the amount you convert becomes taxable income. But again, if you're in a low bracket now and you think you'll be in a higher later, you might save yourself money in the long run. What you want to convert is an amount that allows you to stay under the 15% federal income tax bracket. That's about $36,000 for singles and twice that for married couples filing jointly, and it's on line 43 of your 1040. And the good news about it is if you do convert an IRA to a Roth IRA this year, and then you do your taxes next year before April 15th, if you find out, oh, shoot, I converted too much, I put me in a higher tax bracket, you can actually undo that conversion if you want. The IRS basically gives you a do-over on this particular maneuver.
Yeah. Well, what if you have some money that's not earning anything, just sitting around earning nothing?
Well, I think Pledge Week is in about a month, but for your own benefit, I'd say save more for retirement. If you are in an at-work plan, make sure you're maxing out the plan. That's the easiest way to reduce your tax bill is by putting more money into a pre-tax retirement plan like a 401k or a 403b or earmark it for IRAs and Roth IRAs. Just because you don't have to contribute to those now doesn't mean you can't. You can open up an IRA today and put that in there for 2014. If you're not working or you've maxed out all of your retirement savings, you might want to look at Series I savings bonds, which we're big fans of for a safe place to sock some money aside. And the reason you might want to do it before the end of the year is a person can only open up $10,000, make a $10,000 deposit per person per year into savings bonds. And so you want to get that in before the end of the calendar year so that you can contribute more in the future. And to do that, you do it online and you go to treasurydirect.gov.
What about those who might have more debt than assets?
You might want to think about trying to lower your interest cost, especially if your credit score has improved since the last time you took out any loans, or you've got maybe higher income this year. And especially if you can plan to do this after the first of the year, then your higher income will be reflected on your tax returns. You might also find lenders are a little friendlier now and more open to helping you refinance or borrow at a lower interest rate. And this is especially true if you have high interest rate credit cards out there. Contact your bank or credit union and say, hey, I'd like to talk with you about maybe getting a consumer loan to pay off these credit cards. And the consumer loan interest is likely to be quite a bit lower than the credit cards. And there's usually going to be some restrictions involved with that from the lender. But it's a great way to save some money on interest. Or if you've accumulated an increased higher equity in your home, think about using a home equity loan to pay off some of that higher interest rate debt. Or, as one of the previous callers mentioned, maybe go back in and refinance your mortgage, extend it out, use the proceeds to pay off any other high interest debt that you've accumulated.
Sounds good. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And our next caller is Christine in Eau Claire. Hello, Christine.
Hi, Joy. I have a question for Kevin that I've been wanting to ask for a long time. I have elderly parents, 81 and 79 years old. Unfortunately, they still haven't made arrangements for their estate. And what I'm curious about is protecting their assets. Should either or both of them go into a nursing home? I don't know if there were recent laws that were changed that changed the look at, but I need to take the comment off the air. But I would
And I'm sorry, we're kind of losing you on your cell phone, Christine, but I guess the daughter wants to know how she can protect the assets of her elderly parents who have not made any arrangements yet.
Sure. It's a good question. It's also a very difficult situation for lots of reasons. One of it is that the laws are structured to make sure that people who have the resources to pay for the care that they need actually pay for it. So it's very difficult to do anything at the last minute. Typically, when nursing homes or other types of facilities are accepting applications for people to get assistance, public assistance for the care they need, they have a look-back period that can be as much as 5 years. And in some states around the country, actually, some of those facilities are even after the people pass away, if there is an unpaid or uncovered balance, they'll go back in and look at the estate that the people leave and say, look, this was care that your parents received, and we didn't get paid for it by anybody else, so we have to go back after the assets for it. I would look, Christine, for an attorney in your area who specializes in this particular area. There are trusts that you can create. Sometimes it's very difficult, though, to have your cake and eat it, too, meaning that the parents can keep ownership and use of the assets if they don't go into a nursing home, but then still disqualify the assets for public assistance.
Good luck, Christine. Thank you very much for the call. Next, we go to Mike in Waupaca. Hello, Mike.
Hi. Question I have for Kevin is my wife and I recently got out of a full-service brokerage, and so we're really trying to enhance our portfolio and making sure that we have a good mixture of stocks, bonds, MLPs, ETFs, mutual funds. And one of the things that we're looking at or we're noticing is, as we've sold some assets and we've been able to get into some of the individual equities, what we've noticed is that the mutual funds or the ETFs that really are our growth, which is really what we want, seem to repeat themselves or seem to be very common, not only amongst each other, but also kind of repeating some of our individual equity positions. And I guess I'm wondering, what's your best advice as far as, should we be buying just the individual equity positions and holding them, or is it okay to really kind of mix and match, knowing that you're repeating individual equities with some of the funds?
Right. Well, good for you, Mike, for taking this on yourself. It's very tough to do, but I applaud the effort. The issue with the portfolio is you want to have, for a properly allocated portfolio anyway, you want to have something that zigs while the rest of your money is zagging, basically. And in this Federal Reserve induced party, meaning they lower interest rates down to nothing artificially to try to boost up asset prices. It means that all asset prices have a great deal of correlation, so it's hard to find that. The owning individual stocks is nice. The trick to getting rich over the long term by owning individual stocks is to not care what happens to them, meaning you don't want to invest in individual stocks with money that you may need down the road, because the fluctuations will drive you crazy. They'll go up 100% in a two-year time frame and you'll wonder if you should sell, and then they'll drop 50% in the following year and you'll wish you had. And so the trick, if you're going to use individual stocks, don't care about what happens to it. Otherwise, use cash and CDs to help balance out portfolios rather than keep going off with other forms of mutual funds. Like, you might want to have a 50% cash exposure, like CDs and money markets, etc. You're not going to make any money on it in the good times, but you're not going to lose any money on those in the bad times. And that will help balance the portfolio better than trying to branch out to individual stocks or looking at further mutual funds that all seem to own, you know, Apple and Google and Microsoft.
Thank you very much. Did you have another follow-up, Mike?
No, thank you very much for the time, and I appreciate what you guys do.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike, for the call. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, we will talk about the home of the Butterburger and its national attention that it's receiving these days. And we'll answer more of your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me, you better shop around.
Well, if you are on the road over the Labor Day holiday, don't forget to stop at a certain Wisconsin-based fast food franchise that's getting a national pat on the back these days. And, Kevin, which one would that be?
Many of us are familiar with the Culver's restaurants that dot the landscape along the highways and byways. It's the 30-year anniversary of the first Culver's opening up in Sauk City, Wisconsin, founded by Craig and Leah Culver, along with Craig's parents, George and Ruth. And there are now over 500 Culver's locations scattered around the country in 19 different states, and they have received many positive reviews in the national press recently.
Yeah, so what sorts of national praise did Culver's receive?
Consumer Reports polled 32,000 of their readers who had eaten 96,000 meals at what are considered fast food restaurants. 65 chains were incorporated in the survey, and Culver's received very high marks, not just for good service and cleanliness, but, of course, they ranked very high for the best burger category. And then Franchise Business Review said that recently Culver's received the top honors for they polled their franchisees and said, what is it like to work for this particular organization or with them as a franchisee? And Culver's received the top honor.
Well, you know, Kevin, I can't vouch for the butter burger, which Culver's is famous for, but I can vouch for the veggie burger. I just had one the other day.
So. Mm-hmm. A very high quality item for that arena. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And some people might make the case, though, that Culver's is, you know, not that good for you, maybe more expensive than other fast food chains. What's your take on that?
Well, as much as I do like Culver's, and my kids now have moved on from McDonald's to Culver's, which is meant a significant change in the. We get a little sticker shock at the drive-thru when five people order Culver's versus McDonald's. When,
30 cents versus.
Exactly, you know. Right. But the quality is definitely worth it. And it's not something you should eat every day, obviously, but there are several nutritional options. And then they obviously provide a nutritional data menu as well. And what you find that if you get a cheeseburger or a burger and a small fry and a diet soda or milk or something like that, that the calories are actually pretty reasonable. Price is a little bit more, like we said, but in many people's opinion, it's worth it. You can also save a lot of money by drinking water or getting larger items like French fries and splitting them amongst people, or getting the large concrete mixer and splitting that in several different cups. A real good deal for the kids is the Scoopy Meal, because not only is it $4.99 for a kid-sized portion, but they give you this little piece of paper, and you get a free little custard dish or cone. And what we do is we'll stop at one Culver's, get the meal, and then the next time we're ready to stop on the highway, cash in that little Scoopy coupon, and it's a nice little break on the trip.
And here's some breaking news. Bill Mertens let me know that the concrete mixers at Culver's, a sure sign that fall is on the way, the pumpkin spice concrete mixers available.
That's how I mark time. Just for a notion, if you're doing any home projects, the mixers aren't real concrete, so don't use them and try to build a patio or anything.
So what is this I hear about a secret Culver's location?
Mm-hmm. It's not really a Culver's, but it is owned by the founders of Culver's. It's the Blue Spoon Creamery Cafe, which was opened in 2000 in Prairie du Sac, just north of Sauk City. And it's right on the river there. BlueSpoonCafe.com is the website. And they purport to offer a casual European dining experience, and they do. The food is very good. It's a lot like a normal Culver's where you just go in, order, take your little blue triangle with a number on it to your seat, and it's along the river there. And if you're going to be on the west side of Madison driving up, especially if you're going up to the Dells on 12 there, stop in at the Blue Spoon Creamery Cafe in Prairie du Sac. You will not be disappointed.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he is with us just about every Tuesday with information and advice on your money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you'd like Kevin to answer a question of yours. Kevin in Madison is with us. Hello, Kevin.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I had a real quick question for Kevin, and that is I'm a small business owner, and I wanted to know whether I should start up a crowdfunding Kickstarter program for a piece of equipment that I'm going to need, or use my bank business loan, and the pros and cons of doing either one.
Have you been to the bank yet, Kevin, for your loan?
I have a loan available to me.
Okay.
At this time.
Okay. Do you have the kind of business where you have a crowd that is willing to fund it, or is it something that's a little more esoteric and not quite as consumer friendly, maybe?
It is very consumer friendly, and yes, I think I do have that crowd.
Okay, yeah, I'd give that a shot because you can always go back and go back after the loan again. I would be cautious with the crowdfunding. There are more legal issues there, and anytime you raise money from a crowd, you're bound to get one or two people who either don't understand the situation or maybe have unrealistic expectations. So make it very clear to them as to what you are offering and what you're asking for. But no, I would start with the crowdfunding, and then that way you have the business loan as kind of a backstop for that.
Great. Thank you very much for that information.
Very curious as to what this is, but you're keeping it a secret, aren't you, Kevin?
For now.
Okay. We'll look for it. Atif in Waukesha is with us now. Hi, Atif.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi. I got a question, quick question. Actually, I cannot invest in anything that bear interest, like interest rates, like stocks, CDs, anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
What I need to know, if I have some money and I want to invest directly into business,
mm-hmm.
like not from a stocks point of view, but directly into business, and then, you know, being a partner of that, are there any resources for that?
Yes, I would actually, what I would do is contact economic development agencies in your area and in the greater Milwaukee area and tell them to say, hey, if you get a business that looks interesting or maybe you can't help them out but they're looking for funding, I'm interested in participating in some businesses as some kind of venture or angel funder. Mm-hmm. And also go to the local lenders and call up the business bankers and say, I'm sure you get plenty of people who come in and want to get a loan for a good business, but just because it's difficult for them to get one to start out, you don't have the resources, the capital. I would contact them and say, refer those people to me and I'll see what I can do for them.
All right. That'd be good.
Atif, thanks very much for the call. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Wendy in Delafield is next. Hello, Wendy.
Hello. I have 15-year-old twins who actually managed to have a job this summer, one day a week working on a farm. And they actually have money that, you know, they've been putting away, and I was wondering, I wanted to match the money they earned and put it into an IRA for them. to, you know, kind of start them on a savings habit. But I was wondering, is that going to affect their eligibility as far as college loans?
I would highly suggest you follow through with that. Make sure you make it a Roth IRA, not an IRA, because the Roth IRA doesn't give them a tax break, but by definition, they are probably
they don't have much to tax.
They don't have much to tax, so you're not missing much. It probably will not. Retirement account assets do not show up under the federal methodology of financial aid calculations, and that's the one that comes off the FAFSA. Where it might show up sometimes is in the institutional methodology, meaning many schools use both the federal methodology for federal financial aid and then their own formula for institutional financial aid, meaning what they can offer for out of their own pockets. And the retirement accounts are usually sheltered. I don't think it's going to be enough money where it's going to be a big difference in the one way or the other. And and if it does, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to exhaust money within the Roth just to pay for college if it is included in it. You can still pay for that out of pocket otherwise. And most schools will not include that as part of the calculation.
Good. I was trying to get them started well ahead of time. I'd listened to your show many times, and if they put away money now, it's going to be a nice nest egg.
It won't hurt. It won't hurt. And what we do find is, now that I've done this for several decades, Wendy, is I find that generally kids who see that their parents did something for them a long time ago tend to see the value of it more because it's tangible, because they say, my parents put X amount of dollars aside for me at this age, and now it's worth this much. Now I want to continue that tradition. So there is kind of a, you know, we can talk the talk with our kids about what they should do for saving for the long term, but sometimes walking the walk is a much better way to get them to do it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Wendy, and way to go. Happy for you and
you were
your
a former
kids.
Farm employee as a teenager, were you not?
No, I was not.
You never worked on a farm?
I did not, no. I had a brother who had a farm, and I played on the farm. But no working. Thanks again for the call, Wendy. Elizabeth in Wauwatosa. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, good morning, Joy and Kevin.
Hello.
I have two quick questions about a personal injury settlement. About 2 years ago, when our daughter was four, we were vacationing in Florida, and we were having dinner at an outdoor restaurant resort, and a cat came over and chose to bite her arm and scratch her.
Mm-hmm.
So I did contact an attorney, and the attorney contacted them and all that, and the owner did claim the cat as his own and had no rabies documentation or anything like that. So fast forward to 2 years, and now she's six. And we did get a personal injury settlement. Wondering, the first question is, do we pay taxes on that? And the second question is, she's six now. What should we do with that money? I'd like to obviously save it in the best place to earn the best interest. But I'd like to take it out if we wanted to get her a car, or maybe for one of the semesters or years of college, or if we're able to, is it best to just leave it there and she can add to it for retirement and the years ahead?
Mm-hmm. Generally, personal injury settlements are not taxable. Depends on the case and the designation of the settlement, but generally you will not pay taxes on it. Is the money going into an account, Elizabeth, that is your daughter's Social Security number on it?
The law offices did need her Social Security for various steps that they took for the settlement, but they're going to be issuing my husband and I a check. I believe that then we're in charge of it, but it's for her personal injury.
Okay, and if it's made out to her, like with you as the custodian for her, it's probably her money that she gets access to whenever she wants. You have to use it for her benefit in the meantime while you're the custodian. And I would just put it in a CD for the time being until you kind of get a better idea of what to do with it next. And especially since if you're unsure about the tax bill, you won't know what the tax bill will be at least until next April. And so you might need some of that to pay taxes if it is taxable. And then after that point, you might want to look at setting some money aside in a 529 college savings account for her, and then keeping a little bit aside in case she gets a job as a teenager. And then that can be put into a Roth IRA as well. And so after that, the final third can be kept in just a liquid account that you can use for those various things you mentioned, like a car. She might need a computer, or if you're going to send her to summer camp or something.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for the call, and I hope all is well with your daughter. Here's an email from Anna. My husband and I are in our early 30s and both contribute the maximum amount that our employers will match to our company's 401ks. We would like to do additional retirement savings, but my understanding of a Roth IRA is that there is a limit on adjusted gross income in order to be eligible, and we exceed that limit. What would you suggest we do about extra savings? Should we contribute more to our company's 401ks or do something like a traditional IRA? What about stocks or mutual funds? Our retirement savings only represent about 5% of our gross income, and I would like to get that to around 15%. What do you think?
I think that I love questions like this because the answers are very easy. Anna and her husband, congratulations for your good fortune and hard work and high earnings, but you should definitely be socking aside as much as possible into those 401ks, even beyond the match, because based on some reverse engineering of your question, you're probably at least in the 25% tax bracket. Therefore, any money you get into those pre-tax plans will probably save you. For instance, if you put another $10,000 into a pre-tax plan, you'll probably save about $2,000 to $3,000 on your income tax bill on the following April 15th. So max those out. It's a little over $17,000 now for people in your case per worker per person. So go ahead and bump up those savings. Don't even worry about the investments as much as just making sure you get the tax break on the deposit.
All right. Well, what about the website of the week?
The website of the week is fastfoodmaps.com. So when you're driving around and looking for a fast food particular brand, Culver's or otherwise in a particular location, fastfoodmaps.com. And then we'll also put up a link to a fast food finder app that you can download for your smartphone as well. And we'll have that up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
I hope you're going to find some work-life balance with a wonderful Labor Day holiday, Kevin.
Yes, I will.
And Kevin will not be here next week at this time as he recreates or whatever it is that he's going to be up to. But he will be here the week after that. We will certainly find another financial expert to talk with you about your personal finances.
Yeah, good
next
luck with
week.
That.
Yeah, I know. It's really hard. It is hard. Another edition of On Your Money without Kevin McKinley next week at this time. We are live every Tuesday. Broadcast live every Tuesday at this time and rebroadcast Tuesday evenings and again on Sunday mornings. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Justin Williams for production today. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.